Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM.
Hello, and welcome to Alaska Edition, where each week we bring together local reporters to talk about the news that is impacting Alaskans this week. Joining me, I'm Lori Townsend, your host this week. Michael Carey, your usual host, will be back next week. Joining me to discuss current events this week are Richard Maurer, senior reporter with the Anchorage Daily News, and also Ellen Lockyer, KSKA South Central reporter. Thanks for joining me today. Mm-hmm. Well, it seems like we can't start the discussion without talking about kind of what's preoccupying everyone's mind. We'll start by reviewing this news that's preoccupied a large swath of South Central Alaskan residents over the past month, actually. And that's the crazy weather, hurricane force winds, incredible amounts of rain, flooding, and a lot of damage and cleanup efforts that are going to be ongoing for quite some time. There has been flood damage from Kenai to Talkeetna. Ellen, you just last evening were at a meeting in the valley at the Butte. What did residents have to say about cleanup efforts and how much damage that they've suffered?
Well, it was a pretty well-attended meeting, Lori. I think maybe 60 people were there coming and going, and that's pretty good for that area. The borough and the state emergency disaster representatives were there to help people go through the maze of paperwork now and documentation that it's going to take to get them reimbursement, from at least on a state level now, for their losses. I think that most people were there to get that information. There were, of course, some people who were very vocal about, you know, what they had suffered and were venting, you know, frustration and a little bit of anger. We have known for many years that the Matanuska River is sort of going to go where it wants. I think people were demanding better borough oversight of those flood areas. But when looking back earlier this summer, remember in the late July and August, there were three homes that were threatened by the rising waters. And this was a month or more before the big storms came. So that has been an ongoing situation. I think most people were there to figure out how they could cut their losses. I think what was on people's minds was, this is the question I heard a lot, what's my property going to be worth now? And those are answers that are not going to come easy, they're not going to come fast.
Did you get a sense of how many homes were either damaged or destroyed? Some of them were completely destroyed.
Yeah, the borough has been really good about getting the information out on its website, on its Facebook page, and in many emails to the newsroom. More than 800 houses were damaged. I think the number was like 823 were damaged in one way or another, light damage or heavy damage, basement flooding. 14 houses were completely destroyed. How those people are going to get reimbursed, these people with the State Office of Emergency Management were there to assure people that they would have some immediate money available for basic needs, you know, clothing, kitchen goods, that kind of thing. How it's going to shake out for property value down the line, I think that's going to be on an individual basis, and I am no real estate expert.
What about Seward, the damage that has happened down there?
Seward, the city declared an emergency before the Kenai Peninsula Borough did, and the city pretty much, as far as I know, really rose to the challenge. There was road closures, of course. There was a city-run emergency shelter, which was never used. Apparently, most people in Seward toughed it out and stayed in their homes. A lot of the damage is, of course, still being assessed as far as infrastructure goes. And people have been encouraged all along to document their personal damage, anything they see, anything from wiring out of place, flooded basements, windows destroyed, trees falling on the houses. A lot of the documentation is going to have to come from the individuals themselves. And I think that's the message out there all over the borough.
Well, in Anchorage, when we had the first storm, September 4th and 5th, I think, with the dates of those storms, there was a tremendous amount of damage, trees down everywhere. I lost one huge tree and 20 feet out of another. And it seems as if there's still a lot of cleanup that has to be done. There's still trees down in parts of my neighborhood. Have either of you heard why it's taking so long to get some of this cleanup done? Richard, have you heard anything about that?
I just think there's just a lot of trees down, and you know, some of these trees are down in parks, and really, you know, our parks tend to be more natural than, you know, Central Park in New York, and where, you know, things get cleaned up pretty quickly. So I think it's pretty natural that it would take some time. You know, how much does that really matter if trees are falling in parkland? You know, I think some of the interesting things about the windstorm was how it brought out the frustration of people who were unable to even communicate with the electric utilities, and how they seem to have responded after that. I had been in Washington, D.C. over the summer at my in-laws' house. There was a big windstorm. Power went out. If you were able to connect to the internet, you could see exactly where people had called in power outages, estimated time of when they'd be restored, how many houses were affected. Here, they were told, at least, you know, in Chugach, and both Chugach and MLMP territory, call up. We don't know if it's out unless you call it in. But people were calling in, they'd be on the phone for half an hour, and then they'd be disconnected. I think that led to a lot of frustration.
I think that was, as you said, it was frustrating, but it was also, I think, surprising for mm-hmm. a lot of people that the systems aren't in place to really know where those outages mm-hmm. are, because there's an assumption that, well, of course, they must have a grid where they can see where, you know, this area is out of power and that area is, but apparently that's not the case. You did some reporting about possible new technology that's coming.
That really is not. The situation with power meters and power delivery today is probably not much different than it was 75 years ago. There are smart meters now that can communicate back to the utility about the status of that particular house. We have quasi-smart meters here that if the power company can drive by and get a meter reading. And actually, Jim Posey from MLMP, you know, sort of brilliance is, or genius is taking one technology and using it for another purpose. He, 2 a.m. one morning in the middle of this whole thing, he's sitting there and says, well, I think we can figure out which houses are out. We just send the meter reader trucks down these streets. They'll broadcast to the meters, and if the meters don't respond, we'll get an error message, and we know which houses are out. And so that's how MLMP was able to actually figure out where their outages were. And I think both Chugach and MLMP plan to change their situation in the near future. I was also surprised by GCI and how they lost the ability for people to connect. People who have phone service with GCI, turns out that GCI's telephone service has more in common with like Skype than it does with the device invented by Alexander Graham Bell, and they need to power these little local boxes in the middle of neighborhoods in order for the communications to work, as opposed to ACS, which has two wires that go to a central location. And is powered there. So if power goes out, your phone goes out under those circumstances.
Now, is that just cell service, or are you talking about landline?
No, I'm talking about landline. GCI's landline uses the cable network. So if your cable's out, you also don't have phone. And that was kind of surprising mm-hmm. to me.
When you were researching the idea of smart mm-hmm. meters and new devices for tracking outages, beyond just those meters, are there other technology or advances in technology that allow them to actually pull up the city and see outages, or how would that work?
Well, there already is some of that in place by both utilities, where their larger feeders, their substations, can report back by either microwave or by fiber optics that there are particular problems. So on a gross level, you know, if a big substation is out or a big feeder line is out, they'll know. It's just where it comes down to, you know, your subdivision or three houses on your subdivision, tree fell down, knocked you out. That's where they're not going to know that it happened.
Mm-hmm. Ellen, the railroad officials say that they may have up to $2 million in damages, and that amount didn't include lost revenue for freight and other services. Have you seen any estimates for total damage, or is that going to be quite some time?
Total damage on the railroad? The most recent estimate I got is the one you mentioned, $2 million, and counting, because they have to factor in the fact that they've now got to go through every bit of track from Seward all the way up to Nenana. Remember, Nenana, the northern part of the state, was hit just as hard on different days than the south central area was, and the railroad goes through all of it. So last time I talked to, a couple of days ago, I talked to one of the railroad spokespeople, and she was saying the damage was in the seven figures. That was $1 million, and the next day it went up to $2 million. And I believe they're still counting, because they were not able to send the usual freight trains from Anchorage up to Fairbanks for over a week. And of course, they're not going to do anything until they realize that every inch of that track is safe. I mean, you saw the Gold Creek washout. That was one big washout. Mm-hmm. And they fixed that rather rapidly.
Yeah, so, that was surprising. It was done quite quickly.
And it is sort of the off tourist passenger season. And a lot of the trains ran through it all. The Anchorage to Seward trains kept going. So, but we don't know yet how much it's going to cost the railroad, nor do we know how much it's going to cost the Matanuska Susitna Borough. Last night, the transportation and infrastructure director, Shauna O'Neill, said there was still 40 people out of their homes. There was hundreds of miles of road destroyed or damaged, and bridges all have to be inspected now, the bridges that were in the flooded areas. Sure. And if you go to the matsugov.us website, they have the flood area maps, the road closure maps, and how they've changed over the days. They have the very up-to-date information, but there's still people who are living with relatives or friends. The shelters actually were not used that much until they had to evacuate Talkeetna. Then they filled up. But I know the city of Seward closed its shelter after the first day. They didn't have any customers. And I know at the height of it, the Willow shelter only had 6 people in it.
Well, I want to move on from the storms in just a moment, but the last thing I'd like to talk about in that regard is there was a Senate State Affairs Committee hearing earlier this week at the Legislative Information Office in Anchorage. It was chaired by the State Affairs Committee Chairman, Democratic Senator Bill Wilkowski, looking for kind of gathering information about the response and what people had to deal with. There were senior citizens who said some people had to go to the hospital because after days of being out of power, it became an emergency situation. And when questions were asked of city officials and utility officials, they said, you know, people need to rely on each other. They need to rely on their neighbors, on their churches, on groups to help them. The power companies can't go out and make sure that they're checking on elders, which, of course, you know, makes sense. I mean, they have to focus their attention on restoring power. What did you hear in the Valley about the Red Cross's role, for one? I mean, people do have their community groups and churches that can help out, and neighbors, of course. But what about the Red Cross? How did they respond?
Well, the Red Cross operated the 3 shelters that were set up in the Matanuska Susitna Borough, one at the Willow Senior Center, one at the Sunshine Senior Center, and another at the Menard Sports Center in Wasilla. And the shelters were run by the Red Cross. I know the Willow's closed already. I'm assuming the Sunshine is closed, and I'm not quite sure of that. But the Red Cross is going to open up a disaster assistance office in one of the churches in the Butte to help get, you know, food, clothing, essentials to people who are still without them, who have lost them. And that was announced last night at the meeting. I think the tone of that meeting last night, though, to get back to your original question, was more about property damage than about care. I never even heard the word children mentioned even once, even though the meeting was at an elementary school. And although I may have not actually heard all of the questions said, there didn't seem to be a lot of concern about the safety of the residents. It was more like, how is this going to impact my property and how am I going to get reimbursed? What is my property worth now? And there was a lot of discussion about flood insurance and some interesting discussion about maybe dredging the Matanuska River, which apparently was done years ago, but that was, as the borough officials told me, long before the Clean Water Act came into being. So
tough to get that done
a
today.
A lot of things have to be sorted through right now.
One thing in particular, in terms of a disaster, this was, I don't want to make light for the people who actually did have losses, but this was not a giant disaster. The 1986 floods were far worse, and of course, an earthquake could even be far worse than that, especially something that happened in winter. I think this, we should also treat this as kind of a wake-up call. What do we need to have to be prepared in the event of a disaster where we can't rely on the Red Cross or the power company, but you have to rely on yourself and your neighbors? And I think that's pretty important.
That's an excellent point. It's easy to get complacent when you can just flip the switch and the lights come on, but when they're not, what do you do then? Well, let's move on to, we'll stay with the Valley for just a moment, but let's move on to the Matsu Borough elections,
yes,
which are happening on Tuesday.
Tuesday.
We've got school board, mayor, there's a ballot proposition. Let's talk about the mayor's race first, Ellen. There's two candidates and they have different views on development. Tell us about the differences between Larry DeVilbiss and Mark Mastler.
Yeah, it's going to be sort of an interesting mayor's race. Thinking back, we have to remember that Larry DeVilbiss was elected borough mayor in a special election after the former borough mayor, Talis Kohlberg. He stepped down to take a job with the Matsu campus of UAA. So the special election was in January of 2011. Larry DeVilbiss won over seven. He was one of eight candidates, and he won over the other seven. So he's been in there just about a year and a half. And it's important to know that the mayor's role in the borough, he does not vote. The mayor does not vote. He's a ceremonial mayor. Unless there's a tie. It's a seven-member assembly. If one's absent and there's a tie, then the mayor gets to vote. He does get to promote agendas and promote legislation, and he goes to grand openings. He's the face of the borough in the public. Now, so he's up for his first, Larry DeVilbiss is up for his first elected term, and then he's being challenged by this fellow, Mark Mastler. Now, it's interesting to know that Mastler heads the sort of renewable energy department now that's being set up at the Matsu campus. And DeVilbiss is a longtime farmer, comes from a longtime farming, homesteading family. He's a carrot farmer and beef rancher. And his family over the years has been very instrumental in innovating agricultural procedures in the valley. They got the organic designations to come to the valley. I mean, they were the first people to experiment with this. And Mr. Mastler has a long history in green energy. He was one of the heads of the Alaska Bioneers. He worked for the Clean Energy Building Group and that kind of thing. And so, and was also a wildlife biologist at one time. They're both from Palmer. They're both of a certain age, and they have distinct ideas on development, whereas Mr. DeVilbiss is a champion of the big projects, Kabata, the Watana Dam, and the Port Mac rail spur. Mr. Mosteller takes a different approach. He did tell me who's in favor of the Port Mac rail spur. He takes a cautious approach on the big projects, saying to me that it takes years and years and years of government approval to get those through, and it might be more politic and more interesting approach maybe to get the small projects in, you know, clean technology, those kind of things. Mm-hmm. They have a difference of opinion in that respect. Mr. Mastler told me he was a little bit worried about how the borough was spending its money. He's a fiscal conservative, I would guess, and Mr. DeVilbiss told me that he thought the borough was in good shape. The residents had passed some rather large road and school bond props in the last elections, and So we have those two differences.
And that election is Tuesday.
Okay. And as Mr. DeVilbiss told me, it's usually the forgotten election. It's sandwiched between the state primary and the state November election. So remember, the 6th.
Vote in the Matsu.
Is it the 6th? Yeah.
No.
It's Tuesday.
It's Tuesday. Richard, I wanted to talk about the Coleman Barney sentencing that happened on Monday. Coleman Barney, formerly of the Fairbanks Peacemakers Militia, he was sentenced on two counts on Monday. You followed this case. I followed it some when I could, but you were there a lot more than I was during the trial. Were you surprised by the sentence of 5 years? He could have, he actually got 5 years on both counts. He could have gotten 15, five on one, 10 on the other. They could have ran consecutive instead of concurrent. What did you think about that sentence?
Seemed like just about right. Judges rarely impose consecutive sentences. That's usually for the baddest of the bad. And in this case, I think the sentence reflects the evidence in the case. In as we say in Yiddish, he was a real schnook, you know, a patsy, and was really under the rapture of the leader, Schaefer Cox. And while he did participate in getting weapons that were not allowed, I mean, he was charged with weapons offenses, and that's what he was convicted of. I think, you know, he traced his downfall to listening to the Tea Party, to listening to Schaefer Cox and the Second Amendment Task Force. He discovered the U.S. Constitution at age 35. You know, when most of us probably learned a little bit about that in elementary school. And I think he came to think that his reading of the Constitution, that's all he needed to know about American jurisprudence. Forget about 220 years of court interpretations and legislation. Those are also part of it. And Coleman didn't really understand that. And you really wonder about what kind of education did he have. So given all that, you know, he was he was not an evil character. He was just a patsy. And so it seemed like 5 years was about right. He's already served 2 years. He'll get some time, good time off. So a couple of years he'll be out and back with his family.
Judge Bryant was an interesting judge in that he was very conversational. So it seemed to me, I was there on the day that Coleman Barney was sentenced, it seemed, and maybe I'm just imagining this, but it did seem as if Judge Bryan was really sort of agonizing over the sentence. After he allowed Mr. Barney to address the court, he left the courtroom again and took a recess by himself, and then he came back and talked quite a bit about what the case was and was not about. He said, this isn't about freedom of speech, this is about criminal laws and weapons violations. He said that he was tired of hearing their group called a militia, that they weren't a militia. What do you think this may mean for Schaefer Cox and Lonnie and Karen Vernon in November when they're sentenced?
Well, I'd be a little nervous right now if I were either Schaefer Cox or Lonnie Vernon, because the judge made a particular point about saying that, for instance, Coleman Barney was not a leader. Schaefer Cox is a leader. Schaefer Cox and Lonnie Vernon were both convicted of a far more serious offense, conspiracy to murder. So no one was killed, no one was shot, so he's not, conspiracy to murder carries a life sentence. They're not going to get life, but they're going to get some time. Lonnie Vernon, in the recordings, he may not have been a leader, but he was certainly mean-spirited. There was a lot of things that came out of him cursing this and yelling. And here's a guy who was a trucker, made his living driving on the public highways, and yet he refused to pay his taxes. It's not for me. And you know, there's a little hypocrisy there.
Did you hear, I spent quite a bit of time talking with Tim Dooley after the sentencing on Monday. And you know, granted, he's a defense attorney, so that's his business to defend his clients. But he said, I asked him if there was a racist tone here because of the fact that they were talking about the breakdown of the government. And I said, did a lot of that get started after we elected a black president? And he said that he didn't hear anything in 200 hours of recordings about a racist undertone or overtone. He said it was more about a genuine concern over the breakdown of orderly society. He said they referenced Katrina a lot and what happened after that, that the police were shooting citizens, that they were allegedly involved in looting, and that they were expressing this fear of what could happen and how they could protect their families. Did you hear anything about that? And quickly, we're almost out of time.
Right, I did not hear any racial element in this case. I think there may be racial elements to right-wing conspirators, perhaps in the South, other places. I didn't hear any of it in this case. In fact, you know, you might say often there's an anti-Semitic overtone. Schaefer Cox carried around a Torah, you know, the Jewish Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible in his car. So there was, that element was not part of this, but I think the general idea that the president is a socialist might have played a role.
Their feelings.
Their
that
feelings
he was a socialist,
that he was,
yes.
Exactly. You know, right. That sort of, that conspiracy.
Well, thank you. The time went very quickly. Thank you, Richard Maurer from the Anchorage Daily News, and Ellen Lockyer, reporter with KSKA. It's been good to be with you today. Michael Carey will be back next week.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.